we are pausing our present series on Matthew's Gospel because several times a year, what we like to do is take a Sunday to focus on the wider world in some way. We believe that following Jesus is more than just about our lives here. It means caring for people and situations and what's going on beyond our own patch of land. That's important. Now, undoubtedly, the world's eyes are on what's happening in Ukraine right now. Every day, if you turn on your TV, you'll see the images, the videos of anxious soldiers and shattered buildings and the awfulness of it. And there's also been lots of coverage about people that are leaving Ukraine, images like this. Literally millions of people who, about a month ago, were living perfectly normal, happy lives, and they've become refugees almost overnight, or pretty unexpectedly from their point of view. And so today we're going to use our global focus to spend some time thinking about what God says about and to refugees, and also considering how we as a church might respond to what's happening with refugees in the world right now. Because while Ukraine is big news, there are a lot of refugees from other countries in the world, and the number has been growing over the last few decades. This is something we should know about. I'm going to talk up for a bit longer, but before that, I'm just going to put a video on the screen. It's about 10 minutes long. This is an interview that Jason Ramaswamy, if you know Jason, he has a friend who's based in Sweden and does some work with refugees there. Really interesting guy with some really interesting stuff going on. And so Jason just put together this interview for us, especially for today. So I'm going to put it on the screen, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit more afterwards, okay?
Hi, my name's Jason. I'm one of the partners at Maybridge Community Church. Today is a Global Church Sunday, and traditionally that's where we might think a bit about cultures and situations and settings that are beyond our own country, and to perhaps have a think about how Christians respond in those situations and what some of the challenges are, and perhaps learn something from that ourselves. Certainly it's a good opportunity for us to pray and to think outside of our own little bubble. I have a friend called Phil Whittle who lives in Stockholm in Sweden. He's been there for a number of years with his family, and he's involved in the New Frontiers Network, and he's been involved in church planting there for a few years. Now, Phil's had a really interesting experience. He has had an influx of a lot of Congolese refugees, and part of his role is to advocate for them to try and repair the power imbalance that's between them and some of the issues they might face as they try to set up their lives in a new culture. Now, Sweden are about to have something like 200,000 Ukrainians come into their country, and that presents a whole new set of issues. So I interviewed him briefly across Zoom a few days ago and asked him about some of the challenges and some of the joys. I think you'll find this a really fascinating short interview. And he touches on a number of really useful things for us as a group.
Something has gone catastrophically wrong in the country where you are born, in which you are raised, in your country, if you are a refugee. Something somewhere has gone catastrophically wrong. Usually the main reasons are political instability, could be civil war, could be, as in the case of Ukraine, an invasion from an outside nation, making it impossible to live safely and freely in your own home. Sometimes it's violence, like in Syria, internal, but it's still violence, and it's a catastrophe. You're not safe. Your children are not safe. Your access to schooling work and business are all massively disrupted. And so the options are to flee within your country. The official term is internally displaced person. So they haven't yet crossed the border. And then for a refugee, they are doing the same thing, but they've crossed the national border. And so if you end up in another country, you've got all of that with you, all of the emotional, all of the fear, all of the flight, all of that leaving behind at short notice your country with a complete uncertainty as to where you will stay, how you will be looked after, how you will survive, and whether you could ever go back. So I think one of the first challenges, one of the first things to do when we talk about refugees, a genuine refugee, which is different from someone who's seeking to live in another country for other reasons. So if you're a genuine refugee, I think the first calling on us is to try and put ourselves in their shoes and just to think what that would be like if that happened to us. And what would we want to happen if someone encountered us in a country where we might not speak the language, We don't have access to resources. Maybe our access to money is limited, very, very stretched. Maybe we've spent it all to get to this point of safety, and everything else is unknown. That's the first job. And I think to me that always means I have a huge amount of empathy and sympathy for the person who is a refugee. And so then I think it's kind of incumbent on us as the gospel to extend hospitality to the stranger and the alien, and to do our best to help them in whatever ways we can with the resources we've got.
I mean, how has some of that been working out? You say you've been working with Congolese refugees, and now obviously this is starting to be affected by Ukrainians.
There's a few sort of different stages. So context in Sweden, I think we're expecting around 200,000. That's the high number of the number of Ukrainians that Sweden is expecting. That would be more than Sweden took in during the Syrian refugee crisis, which hit a peak in 2015. Although our church has sought to help a few, we've actually experiencing the knock-on effect of this wave of Ukrainians coming into Sweden on our Congolese brothers and sisters who are also refugees. So you have an initial wave when you get somewhere where they get registered with the government. And then the first is where are we going to stay? There's the needs of your first days, which extend to the needs of your first weeks, your first month. And then as whether this is going to be a longer term situation or not. There's lots of churches that are very, very good, or organizations which are very, very good at trying to help with the first few days. You know, here's a place to stay. Here are some clothes that you might need. Here is some food. And then after that, they kind of disappear off the radar if there isn't a relationship that kind of connects you. What happens then? Where do they go? It's kind of left up to, often in many cases, left up to the refugee to then find a more stable, ongoing, permanent place to live. The challenge we have had depends a little bit on how different the culture is between place of departure and the place of arrival, as to how integration then works and how long-term people start thinking. So there could be languages to learn that takes time, not just to kind of be able to buy your bread at the supermarket, but to be able to get a job, to be able to educate your children, for them to be able to cope in school. Yeah, so for us, the challenge has been that there's such a pressure on housing to house and accommodate this fresh wave of refugees into Sweden that those who are refugees who've been here a little longer are now being said, well, you need to move out of your apartments that the government has provided. You need to move out because someone else needs your home. So again, put yourself in their shoes. You get a letter from the government that says, we need your house. We've got to give it to someone else. And you're like, where am I supposed to go? And they go, well, that's kind of up to you. So for us, we're advocates. We often, you know, it takes quite something to stand up to a housing agency or government agency and say, that's not right. It's hard to do that as a refugee. The power imbalance is, it's not fair. It's not a fair fight. So we often are involved in saying, like, these are the rules. If we think the rules haven't been followed correctly, or if we're saying you've got to make sure that this person can understand everything properly, you've got to give it to them in their language. You can't just, all of these things. So that's what we do. We basically, someone will come to us and say, I've got this letter. What do I do with it? And we have this problem with the school. What do we do with that? We have this problem with housing. What do we do with that? And so case by case, we just get involved and try and help them solve the problem that's right in front of them that we would never have to face.
It sounds like there's a lot of very annoying issues. And it sounds like a very slow, long process. I have some experience of adoption. It sounds kind of similar to some of the adoption process, as in you're building a very long-term relationship where it takes time to trust somebody and it takes time to grow into a relationship. How's it going with your Congolese brothers and sisters? How is that going? And can you speak into some of the joys and the blessings of it, possibly?
Yeah, it started for us when one of them who could speak English came to our church. And he really liked it. And then he started inviting all of his friends, but they couldn't speak English. And so before long, we found ourselves with a Swahili speaking congregation just because he invited all his friends.
It's baffling.
Yeah. Just the context. I think by now we have a group of It's fluid, particularly right now, more fluid than perhaps it's been the last couple of years. But we probably have a group of around, a sort of larger group of around 100, somewhere between 150 and 200. And every single one of them is a refugee. So
that's nuts. I thought you were going to like say 15 people or something. This is like a group.
Yeah, we have a huge group.
I mean, you sometimes post the odd slightly mad worship session on Twitter. And I can tell, and once you posted some stuff from a wedding that you were at, and yeah. I was just thinking to myself, here's this guy who's a British guy who's in Sweden, right? Yeah. So that is a kind of interesting sort mm-hmm. of thing. And then there you are, with this massive group who are just absolutely praising God and having a fantastic time. But I was just thinking, there's this really reserved British guy who's sitting in the middle of all this thinking, what on earth is going on? I mean, you probably pinch yourself occasionally and say, what is this?
Absolutely, every week. One of the blessings, I think, one of the kindnesses of God to me in all of this is many years ago, 20 odd years ago, I worked a bit for a tier fund and I found myself, I spent 11 months working for them in one of their disaster response teams in Burundi. So I actually have been to the part of Congo where some of the parts of Congo where these guys are from. So I just found, like, in the kindness of God, he's brought people to me, to someone who's got a heart for them anyway. So I find so I enjoy it. I love it. But it is crazy. I mean, it's like every time I tell the story, I'm like, what's going on?
Let me just bring you to the end of this. Our congregation is a lovely bunch of people. We have a Worthing for Refugees thing that's been set up, which has been an amazing work. But a lot of us, and me included, we like to live in a very comfortable way. We don't like to have a lot of upheaval in our own lives. The next few months, maybe the next few years, are going to involve some amount of upheaval. I just wonder if you've got a word for our church about how we as Christians embrace this new chapter. Is there anything you can encourage us with just to sort of tie this up?
So I think you use the word I would use would be to embrace it. Embrace it as an opportunity. Yes, it does come with challenges and there's some upheaval, but we always have to remember the upheaval from the other side and let sympathy and empathy. And I think the main thing to go for is not to go for the, not necessarily the practical solutions of food, you know, but the relational solutions of friendship and hospitality. The deeper the relationship, the more fruitful all of this effort becomes, because you suddenly find that God opens up opportunities to love and care and receive and give and all of that. And all of that demonstrates the kingdom of God. So I would just encourage you to say, I think that in lots of ways, this upheaval creates an opportunity for us to demonstrate the love of God and the kingdom of God and the church of God at its best when it is open and loving and hospitable and caring and generous. And these are things which are so attractive in this world. So I would encourage you to think through, what does it mean for us not to try and hold it at arm's length, but to embrace it and make the journey. And I think to make it fun, not to see it simply as a problem, but as opportunity and adventure. And that, I think, from our point of view, from a place of stability, helps us to do that and make it joyful, even amongst the hard graft bits, which will happen.
Isn't it fascinating and wonderful what God is doing with Congolese refugees in Sweden? It's the sort of thing that God likes to do. But the idea of refugees is, of course, not a new one. Interestingly, many great heroes of the Bible had to flee persecution from tyrannical governments seeking to do them harm. David, Elijah, Daniel, Esther, Abraham, John the Baptist, even Jesus. As a small child, Jesus' family fled Bethlehem and went and lived in Egypt for a season because King Herod had ordered that all the babies born in Bethlehem be killed. He was in a refugee family. And sadly, because of the way that humanity treats one another, history is full of people, of course, who've had to become refugees too. But God has always been concerned for these people. The Bible says actually quite a lot about it. The Hebrew word translated as foreigner or stranger or alien appears 92 times in the Old Testament alone, mostly when God calls his people to welcome and to love those who came as foreigners into the land. Early on in the Bible, it says this, which not only reminds us that they've always been refugees, but that God has always been concerned. If you've ever lived outside what you consider to be your home country, and I know some of you are doing that right now, you'll know it's a place of vulnerability. It takes time to learn customs and rules and maybe even a language, and that's hard at the best of times. So in this few verses in Leviticus, God says, when a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord. Now the text says foreigner, and a lot of the foreigners living among the people would have been refugees. This was an instruction that resonated with God's people. They'd been foreigners themselves in the land of Egypt previously, so there was some sense of experiencing what it is to be in a strange land. Now, of course, many cultures have, at least in theory, ideas about being hospitable and kind to strangers. Most people would agree with those ideas, but God sets a really high standard in this couple of verses. Treat them as your native born. Love them as yourself. Now, that might sound really nice to us, get on board with that, but it wasn't is a really radical idea. What about that Syrian family next door? God calls you to treat them just as well as your neighbour on the other side who is very similar to you that you maybe have known for a long time. Or the Iraqi bloke who lives over the street. He wants you to love him like you love yourself. In today's world, the opportunities to live out this command are increasing as international migration grows and grows. People are moving more and more, but the number of refugees in particular is growing. According to the UNHCR, which is the UN's refugee agency, there were 84 million forcibly displaced people in the world as of mid-2021. So almost a year ago, 84 million. Now, it was, I think it was 68 million a decade before. So it's gone up massively. These are people who have had to leave their home, but may or may not have had to leave their country. Of this, 35 million are children. 35 million. This accounts for about 0.4% of the world's population. And obviously these stats are from before the very recent war in Ukraine. For Ukraine in particular, this is all brand new. 10 million people and counting in Ukraine have had to leave their homes. Around 3.6 million, or over 3.6 million, have left the country. Would you believe Poland has, just on its own, has taken in 2 million people in the last month? 2 million. Meanwhile, Romania, Moldova and Hungary have taken in about 1.5 million between them. The UK so far has taken in 12,500. Just not many. Now, you would expect the bordering countries with Ukraine would have seen more people come through, of course. And we're expecting more to come to this country. But we're also a huge potential draw to many Ukrainians because a lot of them speak English. So there's an immediate, slightly easier thing if you can come to an English-speaking country. 90,000 applications were made to house Ukrainian refugees on the first day it was possible in this country. 90,000 people. One or two of them are at this church. I won't mention names, but I know at least one or two people have put themselves down. And at the moment, around 0.26% of the present UK population are refugees. So it's about one in 400 people that you would see in this country as a refugee. What is noticeable, though, I think, is that while there has been huge public support recently for the influx of Ukrainians, which is great, there hasn't been the same enthusiasm over the last few years for Afghans and Syrians, who are also refugees very often. And I have to say, maybe that's because Ukraine is European and generally white. I can't think of another reason for it to be particularly different. So I do think, as followers of Jesus, maybe we need to check our hearts and ask, does race come into it when we think about how generous and welcoming we are as a people? Love them as yourself, those words from Leviticus said. And of course, there's a lot of political voices around all this now, but whatever our political positions, and I know we're quite varied on that as a church, followers of Jesus can't afford to sit on the fence. We're called to extend care and concern and radical selflessness to refugees. What that looks like in practice, sure, might need some wisdom, maybe even some debate. but the heart of it is a sacrificial love for the other. We've got to start there. Now, I should say, of course, because humanity is made in the image of God, obviously you don't need to be a follower of Jesus to do amazingly kind things. Of course you don't. There are wonderful people who don't know God at all who are doing loads of great stuff to support refugees. But as Christians, we should be the first people to put our hands up and say, we will help, even when it costs, because we've actually got more background reason to do so. We know that God adopted us and took us in and wanted to be close to us, even despite our attitude towards him. We've experienced spiritually being refugees who had nowhere to go, but were welcomed home by God. Part of this church's historical response to the world's refugee crisis is that about 6 years ago, we helped set up Worthing for Refugees. And so far, Worthing for Refugees has supported a number of families who have moved to this area as refugees. And as a charity, it focuses on welcoming people in the early days of transition and then helping them to integrate into society. Gay Jacqueline, who leads it, many of you will know her, with help from other people, has set up an amazing model which even the Home Office in this country trusts and relies on. There are more families on the way, but Gay told me this week there could be a fourfold increase in the number of families that the charity supports just in 2022. So over the course of this next year, the number of supported families could grow four times. Incredible. Some of those families are very likely to be Ukrainian. Obviously, it's sad that we need to help people who have to flee from their own country, but what a privilege at the same time. What a way to live out those ancient words from Leviticus. And of course, as we think practically, we can give to organisations like Worthing for Refugees, we can give money, or we can give money to organisations that support people on the ground in places like Ukraine and Syria and so on. And of course, we can pray, and we will do that a bit later. We can even be creative about the resources that we have. But maybe there are some of us who could open our homes. That certainly isn't for everybody. Don't hear me say that. For some of us, it genuinely would not work. Absolutely. Wouldn't work for my family right now, so I'm not talking about even doing this myself, okay? But for some of us, maybe it would work. For some of us, it would be challenging and hard and life-changing, but perhaps it would be the right thing to do. Nobody can tell you that. It's between you and God, but I'm just saying, have a think about it. As I said earlier, I know of one or two families already at Maybridge who are thinking about doing it or have put the application in. Whatever we can or can't do practically, though, there is a game-changing difference for followers of Jesus. With him, there is a hope for all refugees that goes beyond the ups and downs of this life. And it's the same hope for all of us. Some of you will know this verse from Jeremiah in the Old Testament. It's a lovely verse, isn't it? I'll read it to you. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future." It's what I call a great fridge magnet verse or a car sticker verse. There's 52 chapters in Jeremiah and nobody knows what happens in any of them, but everybody loves this verse, don't they? You found that funny, didn't you, Matt? That's nice. I'll tell you what, though, if you read it in context, it's actually even better than it looks, but it's also more challenging, okay? Here's what the rest of it says. I hope you can see that at the back. I'm going to read it anyway. This is what the Lord says. "When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I'll come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. Then you'll call on me and come and pray to me, and I'll listen to you. You'll seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I'll be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I'll gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile." So, when Jeremiah said this, a huge number of the Jewish people had been exiled to Babylon. It was a national catastrophe. Everyone was devastated. It was like the end of the world. They weren't technically refugees, but they were living in a foreign land when they hadn't wanted to be. They'd been captured, basically. Life had not gone to plan at all. Everybody was wondering, God, what are you up to with this? Why are we here? Aren't we your people? Where are you? Well, through Jeremiah, God says, this will last for 70 years, quite a long time, and then you'll find your way back home. Then there's the famous verse, I plan to prosper you, give you hope in the future. We all love that bit. But look at the rest. This God who loves these people says, I'll bring you back from the place where I've banished you, where I carried you into exile. Now, hold on. The Jews are in exile in Babylon. The last thing they wanted. They're hearing this great promise from God. And God says, it was actually me that put you in exile in the first place. That does not fit our God box very easily, does it? It was me that did this to you in the first place. The lovely fridge magnet verse is part of a passage where God says, I'm ultimately responsible for you being displaced from your home in this way that you didn't want at all. That was me. And the middle of it is actually the point. Then you'll call on me and come and pray to me and I'll listen to you. You'll seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you. That's the most important bit of the passage. That's the hope. Yes, God will prosper you and give you a future, but absolutely, that does not mean you will not be exposed to some of the worst circumstances in this life. He will do that. He does. But when people face these terrible circumstances, what's meant to happen? They pray, they seek him, they find him. That's the point of life, to find and know God. So the hope is not that one day God will make it so we can all live in peace in the country or city of our choice and he'll give us all the nice things that we like some sort of intergalactic confectionery dispenser, but that he will orchestrate history to give us the chance that we need to respond to him. The hope is not one day everybody will have a prosperous middle-class life. He doesn't promise that. I mean, that'd be quite a good promise, I guess, but the real promise is so much better. It's God saying, I'm findable. I'm findable. Even in the worst of times, you can have hope because I'm findable. And so absolutely, we should work for the good of the world's refugees. We should be generous and sacrificial and radically welcoming. And we should do that, though, in the knowledge we can't fix it. The day is not going to come when it's all done, when it's all fixed by us. In this life, you know, humanity is not going to achieve that. This life will never be perfectly comfortable. For most people in history, that's been patently obvious. But in our settled, comfortable Western world, maybe we have this sort of idea that one day that will happen. No. The ultimate hope for refugees, just like for all of us, is that through Jesus, who experienced being a refugee and became a spiritual refugee, we have a forever home with God, and he loves to host us. That's the hope. As we heard in that video, refugees are discovering Jesus for themselves in all sorts of places, and it's wonderful. And that's one thing that we should pray will grow and grow and grow here as well as Sweden. It's the same God.